true.
I could be paler.
Yeah.
I have a lot of freckles.
Do you?
Yeah. GW Wompcast, the independent student podcast of the George Washington University's Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. My name's Jessica, and I'll be moderating this episode. Well, Adam and Haley are former co-hosts on the pod, so we're super glad to have them back for this episode. So, Adam, you want to tell us a little more about yourself?
Yes, I am Adam. I'm an OG.
I'm Haley Dunn. I'm an MPP. It's also awesome to be back.
Yeah. And we have a guest with us today, Brian Yanantuano.
Yes, I'm a second-year MPA student here in the Trachtenberg School, and I've also worked for 4 years in the international exchange field. So I'm really excited here to talk to you about the J-1 visa.
Yes, we're really excited about that, too. We're going to talk about the J-1 exchange visitor program and proposed changes to that program and how that's going to impact the United States' relationship with other countries.
Yes.
So
my views are my own. They don't represent my former employer, Cultural Vistas, or the Amazon Education Cultural Exchange Foundation. They're purely my own.
So for our listeners who don't know, the J-1 visa is a non-immigrant visa that provides opportunities for residents of other countries looking to travel and gain work experience in the U.S. So Brian, can you tell us a little bit about what are some of the reasons why people get a J-1 visa and come to the U.S. and what sort of work do they engage in?
Absolutely. So the J-1 exchange visitors visa is a very broad program. There's 15 different categories for people from other countries to come to the U.S. to do a variety of different things. Some of them involve students, mm-hmm. interns, trainees. There's categories for people to be able to teach in American public and private schools, cool. even tribal schools here in the U.S. There's a couple categories for physicians to fill roles, but a lot of the ones that get the most attention are the summer work travel program categories, which deal with people coming to work for mainly lifeguarding positions, camp counselor positions, or positions on very seasonal bases like the Jersey Shore or the Western Coast, where you have these concession stands where you need a role to play, but maybe as history has shown us, that college students and high school students are less and less willing to take these roles. Oh. And so ultimately at its core, the J-1 visa is a cultural exchange visa. So foreigners come here to learn about American culture, business culture, and to travel a little bit to learn about the things that America stands for and the values that make this country great. It gets misconstrued a lot as an immigration visa, which it's not.
Yeah, we'll talk about
and that. Also about people taking their American jobs, which they aren't. They're mm-hmm. going back after a very short period of time. And so it's very important for the U.S. to help build relationships with more than 300,000 foreigners each year that go back and start preaching the values that America has. And also it helps businesses in the U.S. and universities as well build up ties that when they start to expand abroad in their foreign subsidiaries, they already have people that know their company and know what the values are that they can start to just build that relationship even faster than they would if they broke foreign ground without any relationships before.
Right. Yeah, that's really cool. And it's not really a taxpayer-funded program at all, is it?
Most
Can you talk about institutionally?
Absolutely,
like
absolutely. So for the overwhelming majority of the 15 categories of visa, all of it, though most of them are paid for by either the participants themselves or for the companies that are sponsoring them. There's only one or two categories that are paid for by U.S. taxpayers, and for the most part, that is the government exchange portion,
gotcha.
Who fall under the International Visitors Leadership Exchange Program, IVLP,
mm-hmm.
Which is the oldest international exchange program in the U.S. So for the past 75 years plus, we've brought the best and brightest in a variety of different fields to the U.S. to do short-term study tours. So I'm talking 2-3 weeks, maybe a month max, to learn about what the U.S. is doing in that area, and then bring those best practices back to their own countries to form, even stronger institutions.
Yeah, that's so cool. So, about how many organizations are like involved in sponsoring people. Is there a count of that? Or
sure.
Is it,
there is a count of that. I don't know offhand the exact number, but it's in the thousands.
Yeah.
In these 15 categories, so basically the J-1 visa program is a public-private partnership at heart, where the State Department gives authorization to sponsoring agencies to do most of the legwork in vetting these participants and vetting companies or universities or what have you that host these participants. Mm-hmm. And so how it works is the sponsoring agencies can be universities, nonprofits, private companies, or universities or the foreign or state governments to look at whether this person is qualified to come to the U.S. under a certain stipulation of the program, a certain category. if they are here on like a more employment type internship, trainee, teacher, what have you, we also, as a sponsoring agency, look to see if that agency follows the guidelines of the program, if they've been in business for more than 2 years, if there's a certain ratio of supervisors to trainees so that these companies don't abuse the programs and treat it as they are like real workers, whereas this is only a temporary position for them to learn.
Yeah, that's really
cool. And then after that, we put all that information for the student or the participant and the company into a system called the Student Exchange Visitors Information System, or SEVIS, which is used by the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of State to track these participants. And so these people are vetted to a very high degree, much higher than tourists.
Oh, sure, yeah. So this this visa program has been caught up in debate around
wanted to ask a couple more questions about the program. So from what I was reading in the background materials, it sounds like some of the requirements, these are more like people with higher skilled people. Do they also go into like small businesses, or is this really something that like larger corporations would be using?
No, so in my personal experience, it's both.
Okay.
So they do have to meet a certain amount of, how do you say it? They have to rise above a certain threshold in order to even be considered to host these participants if they're in like the intern or trainee categories. I think for the most part, they have to have at least 10 employees here full-time in the U.S. They all have to be at one site together. That the employer has to have a supervisor that watches over the intern or trainee for the entire time that they work here. Excuse me. And the sponsoring agencies, like the organization that I just previously worked for, Cultural Vistas, has to engage in site visits to make sure that these stipulations are met before the relationship can continue, and then we process the paperwork that they need to apply for the J-1 visa. And so that paperwork is called the DS-2019 form, and if we say that the participant meets the criteria and the company that they are going to meets the criteria to be hosted in the U.S., we issue that form. And what that does is it gives them the authorization to set up an interview with a U.S. consular officer at the embassy or consulate in their country. And that that consular officer will determine whether they have home ties to their country and among other things. And if they're found to have successfully passed that interview, they'll come to the U.S. again after being checked thoroughly by the U.S. Customs and Immigration Service and Customs and Border Patrol on their arrival to the U.S. So these people are very highly vetted, and once they're here, they're continued to be tracked through the SEVIS system to make sure that they're still attending their job, they're succeeding at what they said that they would start to tackle in their day-to-day duties, and eventually at the end of their program, which can last up to 18 months or more for certain participants, that they return home. And at the end of the program, there's a unique 2-year rule which says that if they want to eventually immigrate or work in the U.S. or do another non-immigration J-1 visa in the U.S., they have to maintain home residency in their country for 2 consecutive years before they can even be considered to come back here for a longer period of time.
What's the rationale behind that rule?
Yeah, the rationale is that it's not an immigration visa, so even if they're here, they're not allowed to transfer that to another type of visa that would allow them to stay here
it's
longer,
like
such as H-1B.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not treated as a stepping stone, because at its heart, it's a cultural exchange visa, and people are here to learn, even if that means hurting the company that they work for, as in any internship program.
Yeah.
For instance, us here in GW, if we go to intern for a company, we're not replacing American employees.
Mm-hmm.
We might not know everything, which is why we're interning there. And because we don't know everything, we might actually slow down the operations. And it's the same thing for these international people coming here. They're still learning, and because of that, they might not necessarily help the organizations as much as a full-time employee, and so at the end of the program, they'll go home and they'll apply what they've learned to their work there.
So my comment is, you know, I don't think it can be understated just how important this is for American soft power, because, you know, you have that public relations arm in the State Department that talks about how great the United States is, but nothing can beat somebody who's been there and who goes back to their country and tells people how great the United States is, which is especially important because, let's say you live in a country like Saudi Arabia or Yemen even, and you live day to day seeing, you know, the bad effects of U.S. foreign policy. It's good to have somebody there who can talk about the good things about U.S., you know, U.S. society and U.S. foreign policy. And then the question is, you know, staying on the State Department subject, how has, you know, the problems at the State Department, such as, you know, the hiring freeze and the attrition, how has that affected this program?
That's a great question. So I'm glad that you brought up the soft power aspect, because that really strikes to the heart of what this cultural exchange program does. People are coming here to learn about our values and how we operate in regular society. They're not here to work. They're not here to stay. They go back and they take those values with them. And so just like watching a Hollywood movie or listening to American music, they absorb all of that and they take that home for better or for worse. In our programs, we don't just show one side saying that America is great. We also show them that the very real problems that we have. And they appreciate that we're not being propagandistic. We're not being jingoistic. We show them what the reality of what it is like in America. And because of that, it might seem, you know, paradoxical, but that really does strengthen American soft power, because they can see that we're not perfect. I'll give you just one example before I answer your question. We've had, through the J-1 program, in the government exchange category for IVLP and some others, we've brought to the United States 265 current world leaders or previous world leaders, whether that's heads of state or heads of government. And I'm talking about high-level people such as Margaret Thatcher, who came here in 1967, well before she became Prime Minister of the UK.
Whoa.
And we all know about her special relationship with Ronald Reagan. So one wonders, you know, what effect that program had on how she appreciated and reflected American values when she became the Prime Minister. Another really cool example of that, Hamid Karzai, came here in 1987, long before he became the first president of modern-day Afghanistan after the Taliban was toppled. And my personal favorite was the president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk. He came here specifically on an IVLP program to learn about American race relations in the 1960s and the 1970s, and how work was being done at a local level to integrate blacks and whites together. And so we all know the history. He came, he was very impressed by that program. He said so himself. We know the history. He came back to South Africa, and once he became president, many years later, he freed Nelson Mandela and started to topple the apartheid system, for which him and Mandela won a Nobel Peace Prize together. So I can't understate the importance of soft power for this program.
That's incredible.
My experience, we haven't experienced much of a decline in operations. We've seen a lot more programs than we've normally had in the past that we've organized on behalf of the State Department. When I worked at Cultural Vistas, the money and the demand is there, and so we haven't really seen much of a decline in operations.
So when you have the personnel shortage, when you have the shortage of FSO, Foreign Service Officers, is that something that they forego? And then, you know, increase the risk of this program failing at some stage? Or is that something that creates a backlog?
It's more of the latter. In my experience, there are a few embassies where there have been delays, but I don't necessarily attribute that to less FSOs working there or lower staff numbers. I attribute it more to a higher level of due diligence to prevent abuse of this program. personally working on these types of J-1 programs with China for trainees to come to the U.S. to learn. I have seen some delays, but I attribute that to there have been a number of fraudulent applications from Chinese nationals to come here on this program illegally. And so it takes time for them to actually weed out who these people are and to interview them and make sure that they don't come and abuse this program. And so that only the participants, the 300,000 people that come here all around the world, from all around the world every year, are legitimate.
Do we survey the folks who leave the United States and go back to their home countries for like their satisfaction with the program and what they end up using their new knowledge for in their home countries later? Or is there data on that?
That's a great question. So that's one of the hot topics right now, international exchange program evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
At a sponsor level, a lot of companies, nonprofits, what have you, whoever's sponsoring, do surveys of their participants, but to my knowledge, there's no overarching standardized evaluation to see what the change is of people's opinions and how they continue to embody those values once they return, which is the real impact.
Yeah, that'd be great data to have if they work something.
From time to time, the State Department does have evaluators looking at certain issues related to exchange programs.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I've found a lot of problems with that because they tend to focus more on outputs, which are easily measurable, and say, you know, we've had 300,000 people come to this country and return, as opposed to outputs, which are these are the actual impacts of values and actions that these people have learned when they've gone back.
Yeah.
So that's still lacking. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily say we can improve on that, and I wouldn't say that the program is a failure because we can't effectively or accurately measure the outcome.
Yeah.
But at the heart of it, soft power and public diplomacy are about building relationships.
And that's super
sometimes
hard to measure.
That's, exactly.
Especially like changes in people's attitudes is really hard
exactly.
to get. Yeah,
and that's a lot of that is intangible and can only be realized after the fact.
Totally. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I would also think, and not just in terms of how they can bring back what they've learned and utilize it in potentially really amazing ways in their home countries, but, you know, Fulbright scholars are on J-1 visas, correct?
That's correct.
And so we benefit immensely
absolutely.
From having all these super smart people being here, thinking of great ideas, doing research.
Mm-hmm.
I know some Fulbright scholars,
yep.
and they're brilliant.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, I think it really enriches our experience mm-hmm. here at a university. Definitely to have them here.
So one of the reasons we wanted to talk with you about this today is unfortunately there's been this program has gotten caught up in the debate around immigration that's going on right now. So can you talk to us a little bit about some of the actions of the current administration and what they might mean for this program?
Absolutely. So I think it's safe to assume that a lot of the listeners of this podcast are followers of the debate on immigration that's
mm-hmm.
currently happening. And a lot of that is stemming from the Trump administration's actions. I'm not just talking about the Dreamers, which has nothing to do with the J-1, but I'm talking more about their stance toward H-1B, which are immigrant visas that come here to allow foreigners to come here to work.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, there is not a lot of clarity within the administration about who these immigrants are and the jobs that they're taking. And so, as a result, the J-1 non-immigrant visa is roped into that larger conversation about American jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Again, as I mentioned before, at its heart, the J-1 visa is a cultural exchange visa. It has nothing to do primarily with full-time permanent employment, which is what the administration misconceives it as. And so as a result, in April, President Trump signed off on the Buy American, Hire American executive order, which basically, for our purposes here, stipulates that we need to fully enforce all of our current existing immigration laws to make sure that people aren't stealing American jobs and that people are only legally working the jobs that they're entitled to through the current laws that we have.
Mm-hmm.
According to a lot of the sources I've seen, Special Advisor Stephen Miller has really helped him shape this executive order. He talked a lot about the J-1 visa on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair, Bernie Sanders also talked about eliminating the J-1 visa on the campaign trail because he saw it as a way for companies to abuse their workers and hire people at lower wages.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't necessarily say it's a partisan issue. People at different ends of the political spectrum have talked against it at various times, but the mainstream view persists across Republicans and Democrats that this is a very helpful program. And ever since in April when he issued this executive order, we haven't received any more clarification about what categories, if any, this would affect, and also what effects this would have in terms of either eliminating or decreasing the number of J-1 visa participants that are allowed to come to the U.S. each year.
Yeah, so do you have a sense for why this issue, given that it's not really an immigration program, like why it's gotten caught up in this debate?
Sure. I think people don't realize that there's much more to it mm-hmm. than the programs I mentioned before, which involve, you know, interning, teaching, or the summer work travel.
Yeah.
And so when you look at people, for instance, on the Jersey Shore that are manning concession stands or performing duties as lifeguards, it's very easy to erroneously say that they might be taking American jobs because when I was growing up, teenagers did these
right.
jobs. But if you look at the data, there's an article last July from Time Magazine which said that teenagers these days are taking less and less summer jobs than they used to because they'd rather focus on unpaid internships or other types of volunteer activities that they think will help boost their professional careers. And as a result, you've seen a lot of shortages in these seasonal types of positions. And so employers are moving to start to bring in these foreign temporary workers to fill those roles.
Isn't that a problem with the program? I mean, part of running an effective program is communicating what that program is all about. You have to let people, everyday people, who see the lifeguard who is from Pakistan, you know, working there instead of a teenage kid they might have seen the year before, that kid's not there to take that other kid's job. That
mm-hmm.
kid's there because of this great program. So in a sense, that's how the program has failed. And I mean, I think in public policy, in politics, we often blame the people who don't understand how the program works when we should be blaming ourselves for not communicating how the program works.
Absolutely.
And you got to put yourself in their shoes. You know, they're seeing this and they don't know any better.
Absolutely.
And you know, we shouldn't expect them to know if we're not going to tell them.
It sounds like businesses are starting to take up that challenge, though. Like this group you wrote about, the Americans for Cultural Exchange, is a group of businesses that supports these exchange programs mm-hmm. and is raising awareness for them because it's so important for their bottom line that they have enough seasonal workers to actually like stay open, which then benefits Americans who are working year-round.
I was going to make that point because I grew up in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, which is a huge seasonal economy.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing in the winter.
Yep.
And so I worked over the summer, and pretty much all my friends also had jobs, but there was still way more jobs that were needed than there were teenagers to fill them, and most adults already had jobs. So I think, you know, there were a lot of places like hotels and restaurants and, you know, all those kind of things that open up during the summer. If they weren't able to have that labor during the summer, they would just completely go out of business.
Yeah.
And then, as you were saying, their full-time American workers would also be out of a job.
Exactly. But I think you bring up an important point. And I'm glad that there's, like, more of a national conversation happening about this program and an opportunity to spread more awareness about it.
Yeah, and I just want to make a point, too, which I totally agree. There's a lot of people that benefit from this program, both U.S. businesses and foreign nationals and regular everyday Americans who might host these people or be friends with these people who aren't doing enough to advocate the benefits of this program to their peers who don't understand. And so you've seen a lot of movements starting to come out of, say, for like Americans for International Exchange or the different coalitions. I know personally from my previous position at Cultural Vistas, again, I don't represent them, but they've noticed with our new CEO, Jennifer Klein, the value that is there. And so we've started to actually start to talk to people that don't necessarily agree with these programs, but using their own language to show them how the benefits are.
Yeah.
So when she started to assume this role in November, she put out an op-ed in the Daily Caller, which is not typically in a publication that we think would support these programs, but she said these are the ways that they're supporting U.S. businesses, and if you support the U.S. economy, these international exchange participants can not only help you in the short term by internationalizing your workforce in the U.S. by giving them the cultural skills that they need to succeed in the 21st century, but when these participants go home, they're also helping you to build up your foreign subsidiaries, to launch new trade deals, and to ultimately expand the American economy.
But you see, I think that's part of the problem with the messaging. That sounds great if you're middle class, or you're doing well, or you don't have economic anxiety, or if you're a government official who cares about that foreign policy aspect. It doesn't sound like that message is targeted toward somebody who works at a diner, you know, and lives off tips. It doesn't sound like you're targeting like a trucker who feels like his job is under threat, and that he sees all these immigrants taking these jobs, and then he feels like, oh, maybe one day they're gonna take my job.
I
think you need a different message for that person, and I'm not hearing a message targeted or tailored toward that person that tells them how the program benefits them directly in an everyday sense.
And I think that concern for the trucker, the diner worker, is very real, but nobody is coming on this program to work or intern or train in those types of fields.
Right, but I think
no one's taking those positions.
It contributes toward that perception.
But I mean, Haley's example was really informative. Like, I'm sure that having more workers would have benefited the people who were working at Cape Cod during the busy season, because it helps the economy to thrive and to, draw even more tourists.
And it was interesting just learning. I mean, we had a lot of people from, a lot of Eastern Europeans especially, and it was just interesting getting to know and hanging out with a bunch of,
because I
worked in a downtown area where half the employees were here on temporary. I don't think it was probably J1, but I don't know, maybe it was. It was something similar.
Yeah. But I think there's also a responsibility on the part of the folks in the executive branch, and I say this in a totally nonpartisan way, people who are advocating for eliminating this program and kind of putting it under the umbrella of immigration and distorting the messaging there. Mm. The public sector needs to take responsibility for the messages that they're sending about this program.
Well, I mean, anytime
well.
Stephen Miller gets his hands on anything, he kind of screws it up, so.
Right. Yeah. Because I think it kind of goes in, I think at some points the distinction between like what different programs exactly do gets lost. Mm. In, as you're saying, this kind of like overwhelming feeling like our country is, maybe there's like too many foreign people in it, or they're just, it fits into this narrative of, foreigners are here to take your jobs. And I agree. I think that really plays into the immigration agenda of a lot of our politicians, and they have no incentive to try to correct that perception.
Right. And I think the other thing is, with these programs, I think liberals especially have a tendency to condescend toward people who have economic anxiety.
That's totally ridiculous.
Because
these
people, speaking as someone who was raised in that environment, I empathize, and I still have, I share some of the thoughts. Like, I think that there's this perception that you're trying to take their culture away or fundamentally change the culture in some way. And that this is being forced on them, right? And so I feel like with these programs, with this program specifically, it's great because it's about bringing people in and teaching them about American culture and values. It's not about imposing their values on American society, although there is some cultural exchange. The main emphasis is on promoting American values.
Correct.
And I think this is a program that should be highlighted if you want to have a successful message that you
can
tell middle America, hey, we're trying to promote American values, promote American society. These people may look different from you, and they may not speak the English language. They may speak with an accent, but they are here to learn about American values. They're not here to replace your values with their values.
Yeah, kind of making it seem like, look, they want to learn from us, I guess.
Right. Yeah, why don't they want to come, right?
Like, maybe appeal to that kind of thing more. Like, I mean, there are a lot of obviously really great things about America.
Yeah, totally.
I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that could be like a different way of kind of selling that.
This feel like, just to sum up my point, the messaging is always, it just seems like it's geared toward, this is what's great for the economy, just in the abstract sense. Like, who cares about the economy? I care about how much money I'm making, and I care about, do I have health insurance? I care about, do I have job security? You know, and it gets lost in the big metric, in the metrics, the economic metrics we use. You know?
Yeah, I wish that the, like, immigration issue wasn't, like, in some ways, I mean, maybe this is bias on my part, but a scapegoat for this real conversation about people's legitimate economic anxiety in this country and how we're actually going to address it. That seems like a huge failure on the part of a lot of people in the public sector right now.
Right.
And it needs to be addressed.
I don't think it's a problem that started with the Trump administration. I think it's a problem that started with the Obama administration. Like, the Obama administration has some good policies, but the Obama administration was horrible at messaging. They would have these very, like, Obamacare is a great example. They would have these very intricate policies that were not very visible to the everyday person, and they wouldn't do, they did a very terrible job of messaging and telling people about how this was good for them. And I imagine it's probably the same for this program.
Sure.
And so when you have the Trump administration come in, it's very easy for them to mischaracterize these programs because there's no public perception about what these programs actually do.
I'm not sure it was a poor job of messaging. I think it was just messaged towards a different group of people who maybe had different kinds of concerns, which, like, there's just different messaging strategies in these two administrations, right? But I also think, like, there's legitimate debate to be had about different kinds of immigration and what, you know, what our policies should be, but distorting programs and what they do and, like, how they help Americans and also other countries, like, that doesn't do anything to enhance the conversation.
Oh, no, absolutely. But, I mean, look at a success, like, compare this policy, which has poor messaging, to a policy that has great messaging, and that when... I'm going to talk about Medicare and Medicaid, right? Those were Democratic programs, but the messaging was really good for them, and it was very clear about what the benefits were. And so when the Republicans took control of the government, they couldn't get rid of the programs because the Democrats had done such a good job of telling people what the program was all about and showing how it benefited people that the Republicans could not get rid of it. They had to jump on the Medicare and Medicaid bandwagon. I imagine it would have been the same for this program if there was a good message behind it. You know, going into the Trump administration, it would have been much harder for them to mischaracterize it.
I think your overall point is great, that there should be better messaging, and there should be more unified messaging, how this not only impacts the larger economy, because as we know, as the economy grows, more jobs are created and more demand for consumer goods are created, and that in turn also creates more jobs, but also for the individual, which is what you're really talking about.
Yeah.
So there should be better messaging about how this impacts people economically and culturally as well. But I wouldn't necessarily go that far to compare this program to Medicare or Medicaid, where people are receiving direct benefits from the government that are much harder to give up than this less tangible benefit of cultural exchange.
Well, and I think a lot of it, too, is the voting block of who benefits from Medicare and, like,
right.
Social Security. I think that's one of the bigger... I do agree with your general point, though.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Yeah, and one other thing I want to talk about, just economically speaking...
Yeah.
So for in the field of international exchange, of which the J-1 student visa is just a part of, so I don't want to mischaracterize it, but overall it created, I think, $36 billion of economic growth last year in the U.S. and all 50 states combined, and the international education field is the fastest growing service sector export of the United States. And that's one of the few fields in the U.S. that we have that is actually a trade surplus in our favor. So if the Trump administration is talking about, you know, having these fair trade relationships and to benefit America first, they shouldn't do anything to cut this program because that will ultimately hurt us.
Yeah. So procedurally, is the idea that this program would be slated for elimination, like, under the executive order? What kind... It's... In some of the writing that you did in preparation for this episode, you mentioned that there's a little bit of debate in Congress about how this is proceeding, that maybe it's not as transparent as it should be. Could you talk a little bit to that, like, procedurally, how this is going down?
Sure. So right now, all we have is the text of the Buy America, Hire American Act, which came out in April. I already talked a little about that, so I won't reiterate.
The executive order.
But we haven't received any more guidance on how that's going to play out. And so with each passing day, we don't know how or if they're going to propose cutting certain categories of the J-1 visa.
Oh, wow.
In Congress specifically, there is a caucus which advocates for international exchange, and it's a bipartisan caucus because Republicans and Democrats in mainstream thought both support these types of programs, and they recognize the benefits that it has for soft power, for the economy, and for people in jobs in their states.
I was just going to ask, do people, critics of this, do they ever bring up issues, like, concerns about security or, like, national security? Is that ever something that comes up?
I don't think it comes up as much as in the refugee debate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, these people are vetted to such a high degree that they're not like your average tourists that are coming here. So before they even are allowed to come here, they get vetted by the sponsor, the State Department, and various branches of the Department of Homeland Security. And after they come to the U.S., they're still monitored, both as an individual and as a company or host or what have you, throughout the duration of their program, so that if they overstay their visa, it automatically gets flagged in the system and the Department of Homeland Security can respond appropriately. So I haven't heard as much of a debate about the security of these people, although, of course, that risk always does exist, whether people will stay here illegally, and if they do, then they should be appropriately responded to from the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, so it looks like sponsors are the ones who update the information in, what did you call it, CVIS?
That's correct.
Yeah, and so do you think it could be easy for participants to provide false information or not update it and to overstay? Or do you think that's not really as much of a concern as that's not really something we should be worried about?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's always a possibility when you're relying on somebody's word, but again, we always follow up regularly as sponsoring organizations with the participant and the companies, if that's applicable, to make sure that they're still reporting to their internship or host site. And if they move, they're required to let us know as soon as possible. I'm not going to say that there aren't any abuses, because I'm sure that there are, but...
In every program.
Of course.
Sure. So could you talk a little bit about... So you said Bernie Sanders, for example, was not in favor of it because it could result in exploitation of people who are here on these visas. Could you talk a little bit more about what he meant by that? And
absolutely.
Whether you think that's a concern?
So I believe it was in July of 2015, he started tweeting and started talking about in his stump speeches specifically that he wanted to end J-1 visas because he thought that American companies exploited workers, and as a result, not only did it violate their human rights, but he thought that it also depressed American wages, something that he could agree with President Trump on, although I disagree on the premise of that. There have been some very isolated cases where workers were treated unfairly in this program. Either they weren't compensated to the level that was agreed upon, or they were forced to perform duties that weren't agreed upon in the training plan, which has to get approved before they can even get the paperwork needed to apply to the visa. And in those cases, as we've seen, there was one recently in Los Angeles. I think there was a really more well-known case at Hershey Park in Pennsylvania where this happened, and students through the program decided to go on strike and not work anymore through this program. We've seen the authorities respond in a way that help stick up for these participants and stick up for their rights, and because they're so isolated and few and far between, it shows the strength of the regulation and the oversight that the State Department and other entities that have an interest in this program have over it.
Yeah. I wonder if it's sort of in the sponsoring organization's interest as well to kind of make sure that they're adhering to the reporting requirements so that they can continue to participate in the program. I'd imagine that helps somewhat.
I know personally, if we know of information that is either false or if somebody alleges any type of mistreatment, there's a full investigation, and we make sure that the information that we have is correct. And if that participant is found to be in a position where they're not being treated fairly, we have to report that by law.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, unless either of you had any other comments that you wanted to make, you mentioned that maybe you had some anecdotes that were related to this program. I just wanted to give you the opportunity to tell a couple of those stories if you wanted to.
Oh, okay. This is great. This is my favorite part because working in international exchange at its heart is an incredibly fun and rewarding job to have. So just in my past 2.5 years, I've gotten to work with members of parliament from Scotland and from Thailand who have come here to learn about various issues such as our refugee integration, gun control issues, gay rights issues, and how we respond to that at a national level and also at a local level as well. I'll give you a couple of other examples of programs that I've worked on that I found personally enriching. My favorite one has to be with 20 youth from Austria who are all young leaders between 19 and 28. They all deal with protecting religious freedom and integrating refugees and Muslims in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the politics of Europe and Austria specifically, but there's definitely been a rightward turn in policy in those countries against refugees. And so these students came here on a short-term study program through J1 to learn about leadership, American ways of leading organizations, creating social enterprises, forging new nonprofits. And then I took them across the U.S. to Baltimore, Iowa, San Diego, and D.C. to meet people at the forefront, so not just the policymakers at the state and federal and local levels, but also refugees and community organizations in those cities as well, to hear about how we're tackling those issues, because I don't think the debate has been settled here in the U.S. And so it was eye-opening for them to see how open the U.S. is politically, to see how different we are from state to state, and to be inspired by not just all that deep, important policy stuff, but by going to a Baltimore Orioles game or to see Comic-Con in San Diego as it's happening. That was, you know, an after-program activity that we saw as we walked through the streets. And so that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. And that's something that's uniquely American and special to us. So to hear them still, I'm friends with them all on Facebook, and to hear them talk about the lessons that they learned and how they're applying it, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's like you kind of get to see America through these fresh eyes, and you also get to learn about where they're coming from. And
Yeah, that's
so really Comic-Con Vienna?
Yeah, they might start it. Another cool one I was just working on before I left Cultural Vista was a trainee program for Chinese STEM professionals. We had, I placed one girl at a cybersecurity company to learn about customer service in Chicago. And she had the most amazing time there. She had the best coworkers. They've never really, in China where she worked, never really had the chance to like have lunch together, to hang out afterwards together. She went to museums. She was amazed by how, you know, cheap and accessible and engaging American museums are. And I think the coolest thing that she did, her building was also the office of Chicago, one of Chicago's representatives in the House of Representatives. She got to have Thanksgiving dinner with this congressman. And in China, that's almost unheard of, to be able to have these face-to-face conversations. And so I think she was very touched by that, and she took those lessons back with her, and I still keep in touch with her, and she just had such a great time here.
And it's so important to tell the stories too, to help people better understand this program and what it means to everyone who's involved. Well, Brian, this was a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for being on the pod and helping us better understand this
issue. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you so much for listening to GW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. For more wonkiness, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is at GW Wonkcast. And you can send us love letters, or hate mail, by emailing us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher and edited by Eli Richman, with music by Kelly Gunther. Thanks for listening.